Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence, and who, I'm very happy to say, brings it to bear with great regularity on behalf of freedom, that of our country and that of the free world more generally, is our guest for a very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio. He is Dr. Sebastian Gorka. His newest book is Defeating Jihad, the Winnable War. You have seen him on Fox and read his writings, I'm sure, in many other places. He is, of course, these days, the Major General Matthew C. Horner Distinguished Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University, an adjunct professor at an institution I esteem highly, the Institute of World Politics, and many, many other parts as well. But rather than take the time introducing him, let's talk to him. Sebastian Gorka, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be back on the show, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Listen, there's so much to talk about, and I'm so grateful to you for giving us a full hour of your time to do it, because I think it's both warranted on the basis of your newest oeuvre and also, of course, the challenge that jihad represents to us in this country and to our time. Define our terms, if you would, Seb. Talk about what jihad is. It's been described as personal struggle. Is that accurate? And whose definition should we be paying attention to?
Well, Frank, in the book Defeating Jihad, there's a whole section on this, on what actually is jihad. And the blunt truth is it's a concept that has changed over time and has been redefined by men through the centuries. So if you look at the original Quran, you will find that there is an expression of jihad as inner striving or trying to resist temptation. But that's a fraction of the times that it is used. By far and away, the majority of instances where the word jihad is used, it is used to mean martial warfare, so physical warfare. Over the ages, it has been used to target different types of individuals. Firstly, to expand the empire, to use warfare against the infidel, the kufr, to make the caliphate larger. It was used against recalcitrant Arab tribes. It was even used against Muslim leaders who weren't deemed to be Muslim enough. So jihad is a very plastic concept that has changed continually. But the most important thing is to understand how jihad is used today. And Defeating Jihad talks about the key jihadi thinkers, the strategists of the 20th century that gave us the modern meaning or the most widespread use of the term. These are people like the Egyptian Sayyid Qutb, the Pakistani general S.K. Malik, and of course the true creator of Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden's spiritual guide Abdullah Azam. And for them, jihad is very simply the war a Muslim must engage in for the glory of Allah to reestablish and to expand the theocratic empire of the caliphate. It is people like Azam who actually stipulate that jihad is the sixth pillar of Islam. There aren't only five pillars to Islam. There is, in fact, a sixth pillar, which is being a jihadi, which is not an option, but which is an obligation of all believers.
This brings us to kind of the ideological underpinning of this modern concept of jihad. It's described by its adherents, usually, Seb Gorka, as Sharia. And I think it speaks to that point you've just made so eloquently, and that is that this is not an optional business for the faithful Muslim, according to Sharia. This is an obligation. Talk a little bit about that ideological underpinning, if you would.
Yes, the book is really shaped by my belief that it is ideology behind all of this, and this is what we have to understand if we wish to defeat it, because we're losing this war. And for me, the jihadists of today, whether it's ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or even the Shia version in Hezbollah, they are informed by a new totalitarianism. It's not secular, it's not atheist like communism or fascism. It is a religiously informed totalitarianism, but nevertheless, it is dictatorial, because look at what happens when the jihadists take control. Look at what Boko Haram is doing in their territory in Nigeria. Look at what ISIS has already done in Syria and Iraq. When they capture territory, they enslave the population on that territory. If you don't convert, then you will be either killed or enslaved as an infidel. And the imposition of Sharia law is part and parcel of this. There is no option. Once the caliphate controls your territory, it will be run in accordance with a fundamental interpretation of Sharia law, and there is no choice. That is the only way that you can exist. And that is part and parcel. The idea of jihad without Sharia is nonsensical.
Right. And this applies, of course, not just to the infidels, but also to all Muslims, even those
yes.
that may not, in fact, in their practice of the faith, embrace this tradition or be willing to submit to it themselves, let alone impose it on others.
Yes, I mean, it's important for people to understand that the idea of a war between religions is really quite fallacious, because who are the majority of the victims of the jihadists today? They have murdered and massacred Christians, Yazidis, you name it. But it is, in fact, the majority of their victims are fellow Muslims. Remember, I always like to remind people, what was the religion of Lieutenant Qassas Bey, the fighter pilot in the cage? Of course, he was a Muslim, but he was a Muslim who disagreed with ISIS and therefore paid the ultimate penalty.
And Seb, when you talk about this, and again, our guest is Sebastian Gorka, and we're discussing his newest book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War, you clearly are getting at the crux of the problem, it seems to me, of an ideological dimension to it. I want to walk through as well some of the ways in which this ideologically driven holy war is actually practiced. And the most obvious, of course, and we'll start with it, I guess, is the violent kind. Give us a bit of the flavor of how this is rooted in the traditions of Islam going back to Muhammad's own time, his perfect example of the ideal Muslim.
Well, I don't want to go down a rabbit run of the deep history of Islam's founding, but there's one thing that needs to be remembered at all times. Who is Muhammad portrayed as being? He's not just portrayed as being a prophet or the final prophet of Islam. At one at the same time, he's deemed to be the final prophet of the monotheistic faith that has, you know, the prophets of the Old Testament in the Quran. But he is also a head of state. He is the emperor, if you will, of the caliphate founded in Medina and then moved to Mecca. But lastly, he is a military leader. You just read the Quran, you just read the Hadith. This is a man who wiped out whole tribes, Jewish tribes, Arab tribes. Those who disagreed with his new religion were killed if they refused to convert. So anybody who tries to remove just one of those aspects of Muhammad as the perfect man is falsifying what Islam says about him and is generating a narrative that is not reflected in the Quran. And one more thing about the Quran. Every American needs to read one after September the 11th, because so much misinformation has been said about the religion. You should check for yourself, what does it say? And the Quran falls fundamentally into two halves. The one half are called the first half, the Meccan half, where Muhammad was weak, didn't have friends, had to reach out to others such as Jews and Christians. But then there's the other half, the Medinan half, when he comes back from Medina. This is where we find the sword verses, such as 9:29 or 9:4 or 5. These are explicit. Either you agree with the prophet and the new religion, or you will be subjugated, or you will be killed. That is not something that can be passed or interpreted or contextualized. And anybody who says that's not in the Quran simply hasn't read it, Frank.
More to the point, and this is such a critical insight, that the part that has those horrifically barbaric passages, these extreme jihadist injunctions and demands, have abrogated, according to Sharia, those more benign passages. So it is the operative DNA of this system. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that totalitarian system and how it is being practiced in the form of jihad with Dr. Sebastian Gorka straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're having a most important, most thoughtful, and I hope most consequential conversation with the author of a very consequential new book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. Its author is Dr. Sebastian Gorka, now with the Marine Corps University, among other institutions, but a man who's made a very substantial impact on the national policy debate in a whole host of other capacities over the years. You see him at Fox and in other outlets frequently, and we're always delighted to have him with us here. And Seb, thank you again for the time today to discuss in depth the nature of the jihad, what it will take to win it for us. Talk, if you would, about this Sharia ideological catalyst for jihad in one other way, if you would. There are those who insist this is a faith, and as such, it must be treated under our Constitution as a protected activity. If, as you've said, it is in fact, the formula for and the driving force behind jihad, a political, military, legal program perhaps, but nonetheless about power, not so much religion, then it would not be permissible, let alone protected. Just drill down on that for a moment, if you would, Seb Gorka.
Yeah, so let's be clear here. There's no monolithic Islam. The Islam of the Indonesians is very different from the one of the Saudis. But let's go to primary sources again. I like to quote the people who have made modern jihad so powerful a concept. And it all starts with the Muslim Brotherhood, and especially an Egyptian called Sayyid Qutb. In his seminal work that we have captured on high-value targets in every theater, the book is called Milestones. On more than 20 occasions, Qutb writes the following to his fellow Muslims. My brothers, you must understand that Islam is not simply a religion. Islam is a supremacist political movement with a global mandate to reestablish the caliphate for the glory of Allah in a jihad. Now, that version of Islam is the one that is in ascendancy. That is the one that Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Al-Nusra, Boko Haram, Hizbut Tahrir, and the Brotherhood subscribe to.
And it is the one enshrined in Sharia. We're discussing jihad, the threat that it poses to all of us, and what it will take to defeat it, with Dr. Sebastian Gorka, the author of Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. And Seb, I think this is really of such central importance. I take your point that there are people who practice Islam in a lot of different ways. I think that it is fair to say, though, that the authorities of the faith regard Sharia as, a monolithic whole and the true practice of Islam as they see it. When you look at this and you talk about jihad, I wanted to talk about, in addition to the part that most of us have been confronting graphically in New York and in London and in Paris and Brussels and San Bernardino and elsewhere, of the violent kind, of something else, something called Hijra, and the practice that that it involves in spreading the faith, spreading the jihad, if you would. Would you discuss that, particularly in the light of what's happening in Europe at the moment?
Yeah, well, I think Hijra, most importantly, I mean, it can be applied to a certain extent to the immigration crisis, but I think it's more important to understand how the terrorists actually use it operationally. So Hijra is the word used to describe Muhammad leaving Mecca, being pushed out of Mecca, going on a very difficult, arduous emigration across the desert to arrive in Yathrib, the future Medina, and being victorious there and coming back a mighty warrior. So it's a very condensed concept that connotes rejection, arduous migration, and then victory as a mighty warrior. The Hijra has also been used to describe the actions of jihadis, such as the 19 hijackers, that they have to leave pagan land. Saudi Arabia or Egypt isn't Muslim enough. They go on arduous emigration. Remember, most of the 9/11 hijackers executed their mission or prepared for it outside of their native nations, most often in Germany, and then finally they arrive at their destination in glory as mighty warriors, in this case by flying planes into buildings full of unarmed civilians. That's a very, very important use of the concept Hijra by groups like Al-Qaeda. It has also been used or applied to what is going on in the undermining in a non-physical sense of the European continent, but these are the kinds of concepts that are not discussed adequately, and the ones that I talk of in Defeating Jihad.
Indeed. Another is a concept known as zakat, and I think, in its application, it more or less translates into material support for terrorism, at least in part, Seb Gorka. How does that fit into this sort of jihadist tradition and practice these days? And how in terms of the threat we're facing, serious is that a component, do you think?
So zakat is one of the original five pillars of Islam. It's often translated as almsgiving or charity, which isn't correct. The analog or the closest one is tithing, because it is mandatory and it is at a fixed rate. Now, traditionally, zakat is the money that you must put back into the community through the local mosque, and which will be used for charitable purposes over the years, over the centuries. They have identified in the Muslim faith who the primary recipients of this tithing should be. And at the top of the list, we have widows and orphans. However, and it all seems to go back to the Brotherhood, Frank, the Brotherhood has succeeded over the last 25 years to convince many people that zakat shouldn't just be spent on the unfortunate, on the widows and orphans, but the tithing amounts that the Muslim believer pays back into the community should be used to fund jihad. And the Brotherhood has done a very good job in inculcating this belief that this is part of your obligation. If you can't fight jihad yourself, which you should be doing, then your monies should be used to fight those who actually are doing jihad on your behalf or for the glory of Allah.
Yeah, and in fact, this is as estimable an activity as wielding the sword yourself, I think, in that tradition. You've brought to the fore, very importantly, Seb Gorka, the Muslim Brotherhood, both with reference to, its ideology and its sort of role in leading this Islamic supremacist movement of the moment. Talk, if you would, about the particular way in which the Brothers, as part of their milestones, strategy are practicing jihad in a form they call civilization jihad.
Right. So the Muslim Brotherhood has to be understood as the grandfather of all jihadi movements. It doesn't matter who they are or where they're located. They are the progenitors of it all. This is an organization that was created just 4 years after the dissolution of the caliphate by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk with the express mandate to reestablish the caliphate. And in Defeating Jihad, I walk my readers through how the Muslim Brotherhood laid the foundations for modern jihad that would later be picked up by groups like Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden and ISIS today and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And the point is very clear here. The Sharia, the ideology, the violence is there to purify the world. Islam has lost its way, and the only way it can be great again is if it excises disbelief, either through conversion or through murder or through enslavement. This is really as simple as it gets. Islam must be great again. Jihad is the tool to that greatness, and Sharia is the system that will be imposed once Islam is victorious again.
Mm. The piece of this that I'm particularly interested in, we have to pause in a moment, we'll be right back to discuss this in more detail with you, Seb, is what a jihadi does, according to the Muslim Brotherhood, when he finds himself not strong enough to use violence decisively. It's a whole nother kettle of fish, in a manner of speaking. And we'll talk about both what it means sort of at the theoretical level, at which you are an expert, Seb Gorka, but also in practice, not just elsewhere, but here in the United States. That and more with Dr. Sebastian Gorka, the author of Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The strong silent type is a well-known American character. Unfortunately, when it comes to Vladimir Putin's serial and escalating provocations, President Obama appears to be the silent, weak sort. In a recent phone call with Putin, Mr. Obama didn't mention increasingly aggressive behavior by Russian warplanes. His press spokesman justified the president's failure to do so, saying, quote, "These kinds of incidents, while provocative and concerning, are not particularly unusual," unquote. Failing to object to dress rehearsals for aerial bombing runs on our ships and maneuvers that endanger our aircraft is a formula for such incidents and worse, becoming more usual. The best way to preserve peace is through strength, not weakness, and by saying, and convincingly demonstrating, that we will exact a heavy price for any future repetition of such threatening behavior by Russia, China, or other potential or actual adversaries. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back for a very, I think, important conversation with a man who has given great thought and been hugely influential in understanding the nature of the enemy we're facing these days in what I call the war for the free world. He is Dr. Sebastian Gorka. He is, among other things, a co-author of Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies from Communism to Islamism, and also, most recently, the brand new book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. There's a theme here we're going to come to in a moment, which is what do we do about all this? But just to finish sort of laying the groundwork of what we're up against, Seb, let me just ask you about how this civilization jihad bit is in practice a complement to the violent kind, the hijra, the zakat, how this idea of using subversion to accomplish the same ends really ties in to the larger danger we're facing.
Right. So this is a very, very key point to the book itself, that just like the communists, they realize there's more than one way to win a war. You don't necessarily have to engage in kinetic warfare. You can undermine your enemy from the inside. So conspiracy, subversion, and influencing people, the people that the Kremlin used to call the useful idiots, or having people in positions of power who can change policy, not necessarily in an overt way, but in an influence-peddling fashion. So the idea here is that you simply start to inculcate your values into the other civilization in a way that sooner or later it becomes impossible for anybody to disagree with that which you are trying to create. We saw this with communism. We saw this with other types of subversive organization. And the Muslim Brotherhood understands this. Just look at what it has done in the Middle East even before it started to implement its concept for civilizational subversion in the West. Look at the actions, the recent events in Egypt. You can take over a nation by actually using democratic tools against it. And again, this is not well understood. We focus on the Boston bombing, the San Bernardino massacre, 9/11. Yes, horrific and an immense threat to the security of Americans. But there are other ways to lose this war if you wake up one morning and find that the constitutional facets of our system have been changed without a shot being fired.
Freedom of speech being one of those that's most endangered, it seems to me, and why this kind of conversation is so important, Seb Gorka. Let me just ask you, you're not only a distinguished professor in these areas, but a serious student of them as well. You mentioned the parallelism to communism, both as a sort of totalitarian ideology, the Sharia business. I wonder if you might explain, I kind of think of this as communism with a god. But Seb, what were the ties in between the communists in the day and the Muslim Brotherhood? And did one teach the other about the fine arts of subversion and stealthy means of accomplishing this same purpose?
Well, the real master at that, and I'm sure you've had him on the show, is Jack Ziak. So he has written, and he's the author of Czechisti, and he's really the master of the concept that the state security model that the Soviet Union created, the kind of 1984 Big Brother model, was something that was actively exported to the Middle East in the 50s. And as a result, there are certain actors, the Muslim Brotherhood being the primary group, that absorbed the lessons from the dictatorial model that was the Soviet Union, and to this day is using them incredibly successfully in those areas where it cannot win frontally and in the open, but where it must do so covertly and in a subversive manner. So yes, there's absolutely an overlap between what the communists did to undermine democracy and liberty and what groups like the Muslim Brotherhood are doing today everywhere, and they learned the lessons from one another.
Now, and I understand some of their leaders actually have, and those who've gone on to lead other jihadi groups of the violent kind, have actually studied at places like the Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow. So this is a direct tie-in. Now, Seb, having heard all of this, and I think it's absolutely right, of course, but I wonder how you respond to the libel, really, that when you make these kinds of points, rooted as they are in scholarship in your case and in fact, this is really nothing more than a conspiracy theory. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I enjoy conspiracy theories for entertainment, but I always remind people they're called conspiracy theories for a reason, because they're not based on fact. I avoid this criticism very simply. As a friend of mine in the intelligence community says, the best weapon you have is you simply footnote. Don't listen to me. Don't listen to Dr. Gorka. Listen to the primary sources. Buy a Quran. Read it. Read the works of the jihadists, Kutub, Azam. Read the fatwas issued on jihad during the 1979-89 first Afghan war. These are all the primary sources that are driving the global jihadi movement today. If you wish to deny the facts of the case, you have every right to, but don't expect me to then consider you as living in a reality. This is the problem with the current administration. If you state that ideology is irrelevant, terrorism is a function of poverty and lack of education, well, you are living in an Alice in Wonderland fantasy. I'd like to stay with the facts, and the facts are global jihad is very powerful, and it is growing, and it is an imminent an existential threat to the security of the Republic.
A central tenet of your new book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War, with which I completely agree.
You know, one of the things that's striking about this, of course, Seb, is that the other documents that are so helpful are more contemporary, not completely contemporary, but fairly recent, notably the project and the explanatory memorandum on the general strategic goal of the group in North America. These are further evidence, as you say, that we're dealing not with theories, but we're dealing with an actual conspiracy. I want to come to America in a moment, but just to finish this up, Seb, if you would, one of the insights it seems to me that one should take away from what we've learned about the most recent attack in Brussels, the violent kind of jihad, was the kind of infrastructure that the jihadists were able to draw upon, to use to plan and plot and execute their attacks, but also to conceal themselves in, right? You know, in the heart of the capital of Europe, by some accounts. Would you just describe the role that the Brotherhood in particular has played in building that infrastructure in places like Brussels?
No, it's absolutely shocking. One just needs to look at one fact. We have the most wanted man in Europe, so the man behind the Paris attacks, who is at large. Everybody thought he'd skipped off to Syria or Iraq or somewhere. No, lo and behold, what do we find? This man is hiding in plain sight in the equivalent of the capital of the European Union in Brussels. And this is the function of not only the conspiratorial establishment of a network of support structures across the continent, but also the abject failure of the political elite in Europe to understand the consequences of their multicultural postmodern attitudes to immigration and to the influx of people from other cultures into their nations. If you say that everything is morally relative, all cultures are equal, and then allow millions of people into your country who then do not have to integrate because of your worldview, then you will create situations that the bad guys will exploit mercilessly, and areas where there will be succor given to terrorists after they have executed an attack and before they prepare a next one. This is the sad reality that Europe has created for itself. They have created an absolute haven for the jihadists across the whole continent. And as we see from Madrid to London to Brussels to Paris, it has borne a very, very bitter fruit.
And more is in the offing, we're told, including potentially spectacular attacks against perhaps nuclear power plants and heavens knows what all else. Seb, I want to turn to the United States after a brief pause here and see whether what you've just described, and it's a very powerful but I think very accurate indictment of the political elites and their devotion to multiculturalism and the blind eye they've turned to the jihadists of these various stripes and the enabling thereby that they've done for them, and see to what extent is that also true here in the United States of America. That and more with Dr. Sebastian Gorka, the author of Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back in our fourth segment of this very, I think, insightful conversation with Dr. Sebastian Gorka, a man for whom insight is a daily function and job. It's a great pleasure to have him with us to talk in detail about his newest book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. And before we get to the part that I think is most important, and that is your recommendation, Seb, as to what we do need to do to win, let's round out this conversation about what we need to win against by talking about the extent to which what you've just described in terms of the state of affairs in Europe, notably, other Western societies in which the blind eye has been turned to the Brotherhood and its civilization jihad and the enabling thereby of an infrastructure that is a catalyst and facilitator for the violent kind of jihad. To what extent do we see evidence of these same forces at work here in the United States?
Well, my gosh, where to begin? It's really very shocking. The fact is American policy is predicated on the following analysis that came out of an individual based at NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center. This former academic said that the only way to save America from another September the 11th is to negotiate with the Muslim Brotherhood, because the Muslim Brotherhood are the only people who can save us from groups like Al-Qaeda. That became a platform of American U.S. foreign policy, and it led to the kinds of things we saw in the so-called Arab Spring that should better be called a Christian winter, under which this administration completely befriended and was on the side of Mohammed Badia and Mursi, the Muslim Brotherhood candidates and future government of Egypt. They truly believed that that version of the jihadi mantra, of the jihadi ideology, because it was simply slightly less kinetic than the Al-Qaeda version, were people we could do business with. So an inestimable misdiagnosis of who these people are, and a willful blindness to the fact that there is no such thing as a good jihadist. There's just a difference in the speed with which they will wish to enslave you. So the influence of the Brotherhood or the Brotherhood's influences on U.S. government is truly quite shocking in the last 7 years, Frank.
Do you feel that is in part not simply because of, and I think that term Christian winter is extraordinarily powerful. It evokes very accurately what happened, of course, and is continuing to happen to Christians by the tens, hundreds of thousands, maybe more in the Middle East, most especially, Seb. But do you find that the degree to which this blindness on the part of the willful blindness, our friend Andy McCarthy calls it, to the Muslim Brotherhood has in part been because inside the United States government, we've actually seen, frankly, starting under the Bush administration, but particularly under this one, the Muslim Brotherhood successfully practicing its civilization jihad by penetrating the U.S. government and exercising influence from within.
Let's just talk about one organization. Let's talk about CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations. The fact that an organization which was listed in the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history, the Holy Land Foundation trial, as an unindicted co-conspirator, the fact that CARE not only was able to be in a position to give advice to the Obama administration on how they should deal with the threat of terrorism, but in fact, along with its cohorts, managed to convince the administration 5 years ago that there must be a wholesale censorship of all counterterrorism training in federal government, such that religion cannot be mentioned, not even the word jihad. I think that speaks for itself. That is a bad actor shaping and influencing not only U.S. policy, but our capacity to prepare our war fighters and our agents that are fighting this war. As a student of mine at National Defense University once wrote in his dissertation, once the enemy is in a position to decide what you are allowed to say about them, then you have already lost the war.
Indeed. And this really, in addition to the trainers being restricted and the training materials being restricted and even the lexicon that is allowed to be used being, very severely censored. We've had policies that have been adopted that I think, again, bespeak the influence of not just the Council on American Islamic Relations, but the Islamic Society of North America, and now this U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations, an umbrella group that is designed, they say, to be a political party. These are all forces that are clearly subverting us from within. And I just wonder, Seb, when you look at something called the Countering Violent Extremism Project, which is sort of the umbrella under which this administration's various efforts to you know, accommodate, appease, submit to the Islamists is going forward. Do you see there sort of a focus of what needs to be corrected? And let's talk a little bit about the kinds of corrections that are required.
Oh, absolutely. So as I write in Defeating Jihad, for me, CVE, the next president, that has to utterly and wholly jettison this concept of violent extremism or countering violent extremism. That phrase, along with the concept lone wolf, are ideas, are phrases meant to make you stupid. They are meant to make the American citizen disconnect the dots. We are not facing some kind of amorphous violent extremism with no name. We are facing a very specific one. It is people who believe they are holy warriors for Allah. That's not violent extremism. That is jihad. And that is why I say we must start talking about the enemy as the enemy talks about themselves. This is what we did during the Cold War. This is what Reagan did. He understood the threat and he was truthful in his assessment, and there was no politics in the threat assessment, no political correctness. So that's rule one, that I have a plan to defeat these people in Defeating Jihad, and part one is exactly that. Jettison the garbage that obfuscates and start talking honestly about who the enemy is and what they believe.
And, you know, the sort of corollary to that obfuscation of who the enemy is, of course, has been the effort using, among other things, the euphemism of violent extremism to suggest that, oh, no, the real problem is over there, folks. It's those constitutionalists. It's those Tea Party activists. It's the anti-abortion
can
people.
Can I share
and so
with Frank? Do we have time for me to share an anecdote with you?
We do.
So 2 weeks ago, I spent 8 hours with 250 law enforcement officers in the Midwest. I gave them my whole data dump on how the enemy thinks. So 8 hours on jihadi ideology and the threat to America. After the full day, a very pretty young girl walks up to me at the end and says, Dr. Gorka, that was very impressive, but I do disagree with you. I'm from the Department of Homeland Security, and you do know that the primary threat these officers face in America are militias and white extremist groups. That's the narrative. That's the narrative.
It is the narrative of the Muslim Brotherhood, I think, very importantly. And I think that what you've just described, Seb, is simply evidence of the degree to which it is now permeated. You know, our friend and colleague Claire Lopez and I have just done a book that's perhaps a nice companion to yours called See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism and the Disarming of America's First Lines of Defense. And I think what you've described is so redolent of what's been happening that it is truly a scandal. And it is one that I think unless the American people awaken to before something terrible happens as a result, they are going to be shocked into action after something very, very bad, perhaps much worse than anything we've experienced to date occurs. Seb, we have to pause again for a final break. We'll be right back and a much more expansive discussion of your recommendations out of Defeating Jihad for what America must do to win this winnable war. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Now, having set the table for a discussion about what must be done to win what our guest, Dr. Sebastian Gorka, calls the winnable war, we're going to turn to how, in practice, we actually can defeat jihad. And so, again, let me just say how much I appreciate both the work you do at the Marine Corps University and the Institute of World Politics and Fox and elsewhere to help explicate the kinds of themes that you're talking with me about today and that are at the core of your book, but in particular, the clarity that you're bringing to the nature of the problem. And I think we've done a good job of laying that out. So give us in a little bit more detail what your recommendation is. Again, it starts with a new president. It starts with clarity about the nature of the enemy. But what's the next step?
Yes. So my recommendation to defeat the global jihadi movement is a function of my upbringing and my experience during the Cold War. I see the Cold War as a war against a totalitarian ideology and one that we actually were victorious in. And I use that as a template for today's challenge. The Cold War was shaped by two key secret documents. The first one was George Kennan's Long Telegram, and the second was the document called NSC 68. And I use that as my template to defeat groups like ISIS today. Firstly, we need a description of the enemy threat doctrine of our foe. That's what Kennan's Long Telegram was, his secret cable from Moscow back to D.C. in 1946 that laid out why communism as an ideology is the personality of the Kremlin and why that ideology and the nation that it drives is an existential threat to all that we believe in the West and to all that we hold sacred. That was the basis of Truman's containment policy, and that led to the drafting of a top secret document called National Security Council Memo 68. That was the plan that was drafted to not only build up a strong West that could oppose the Soviet Union should the war become a physical one, but also the ways in which the ideology could be undermined inside the Soviet Union and outside through an information campaign. That is the model for today. We need to have clarity about what the enemy believes. We have to be clear upon their ideology of jihad, Sharia included. And most importantly, we have to use that as the platform for our strategic response, which must include the strengthening of those Sunni nations in the region that wish to be our allies, foremostly the Kingdom of Jordan and Egypt. And on top of that, we must have a gargantuan counter-propaganda campaign, just as we did during the Cold War with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Voice of America, things that we simply do not do today because we are not allowed to talk about religion or jihad. These are the tools to victory, and if we have leadership in the White House, it could bring victory very, very quickly.
Let me ask you one other sort of seminal document, it seems to me, in that period was, of course, Ronald Reagan's National Security Decision Directive 75. We used that as sort of a template for another product of our Center for Security Policy, the Secure Freedom Strategy. And I think it parallels very closely what you've talked about here. Again, the clarity about the nature of the enemy and devising a strategy that brings all instruments of national power to bear was really the project of Reagan's to take down the Soviet Union. And your point about the propaganda is, of course, a loaded term, and a lot of people recoil from it. But whether it's information operations or influence operations or propaganda or simply telling our story and making clear the true nature of this horrific enemy and its ideological totalitarian doctrine, it is central, of course, to what we're doing. What do we need to do in addition to getting a new commander-in-chief? But institutionally, Seb, as a guy who's thought a lot about this, to give us the capabilities to use information operations, for want of a better term, effectively.
Wow. Let me just note that propaganda does bring out the worst in people in terms of reaction, but propaganda simply means influencing people to share your values. That's what the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith, where the word propaganda comes from originally, that's what it means. So, you know, having people share our values, not a dirty word. What will it take? It will take many things. It will take bringing the people who understood how to do this during the Cold War back into the fold. And most importantly, we have to do this at a strategic level. We do information operations, the PC term, at the tactical level today, almost exclusively. It's not driven out of the White House by the commander-in-chief as it was under Reagan. That's what needs to happen. There's a wonderful model for this as well. Some of the best Cold War warriors were part of this, and that's the Active Measures Working Group. The Active Measures Working Group was an interagency organization that shone the light of truth on Soviet propaganda and was incredibly effective in delegitimizing the Soviet Union and winning the Cold War. We need things like the Active Measures Working Group for Jihad today, and we need leadership in the White House to give them the power to take the fight to the enemy on the ideological plane.
Yeah. You know, I might quibble on one point, or at least clarify. I think there's very little doubt that the commander-in-chief at the moment is driving the narrative. It's just driving it in the wrong direction. We need one who's driving it back the right way. Hey, Seb, of course, at the moment, one of the topics du jour, because, of course, the president of the United States is there, is the Saudis. I noted that in your description of Sunni Middle Eastern allies, you didn't happen to mention the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. This is a bit, again, of a loaded topic, but would you walk through the role that the Saudis are playing at the moment? Are they enemies? Are they reliable allies? Are they frenemies? What's afoot here, and what should our policy and posture be vis-a-vis the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia?
Right. In a TV interview recently, I said that their attitude to terrorism and their attitude to America is a half-pregnant one. I detail the reason for this in Defeating Jihad. Saudi Arabia has a problem. Saudi Arabia cut a deal with the devil in 1979 when a group of jihadists besieged and captured the holiest site in Islam, the Grand Mosque at Mecca. For the next two decades plus, elements of the Saudi regime were complicit in the support for the export of jihadi ideology across Dar al-Harb, across infidel lands. After 9/11, they reassessed things, but again, they were not wholehearted in their support of what we were doing. Publicly, some good things happened. Privately, at least key individuals maintained their support for the bad guys. After al-Qaeda attacks in Saudi Arabia, they've reassessed things again in 2005, 2006, but we still do not have a wholehearted commitment to undermine the ideology of the jihadists. And this is part and parcel of their history. Remember, Saudi Arabia was established as a theocratic institution or nation in a compact between the House of Saud and a man called Wahhab, the man whose name is the description of Wahhabism, one of the most puritanical forms of Islam existing today. So Saudi Arabia has to decide whose side it is on, and Saudi Arabia has to have some kind of coherence in its U.S. policy towards the United States. What should we do? We should have some very tough conversations behind closed doors, as we used to do in the past, and not pretend that everything is just hunky-dory.
Boy, that you said a lot there. I'm not sure whether the pact with the devil didn't predate the 1979 episode. I think you may have described it with the deal with Wahhab. But Seb, very quickly, should the government of the United States declassify the 28 pages that describe the role that the Saudis apparently played in 9/11?
I think so, yes. My wife was talking to one of the family members of the victims of 9/11 just 2 days ago. I think they deserve justice. I doubt, if you listen to the fact that both Republican and Democrat members of Congress who have read it say it is time to release, I think it doesn't endanger methods or sources, and as a result, it has to be released.
Yeah, it may endanger the relationship, however, which is, I think, in need of, as you say, at least some very stern conversation, if not some fundamental reappraisal. We appreciate tremendously your work and that of your esteemed wife, Katie Gorka, the co-author of some of your other works. Keep up the tremendous effort you both are making, and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.